6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war.
Today is Friday, November 16th, and you're listening to A Public Affair. My name is Anjali Brecky, and I'll be subbing for Esti Dinur. Today, we'll be discussing how our economic system is contributing to environmental degradation. With us by phone is longtime environmental activist Chris Williams, professor of physics and chemistry at Pace University and author of Ecology and Socialism. In his book, Williams writes, "We live in a social system predicated on endless expansion. One that sickeningly combines historic and gargantuan amounts of wealth alongside oceans of poverty and mountains of waste. It is no exaggeration to state that without swift, dramatic, and profound changes to societal priorities, including a fundamental reorientation away from fossil fuel-based energy and profit-driven capitalist economic growth, the generation growing up today will be, in all likelihood, the last to know climate stability." We will be discussing these issues, the issues covered in the book, throughout the hour. Hello, Chris, and welcome to A Public Affair.
Hello. Thanks for having me on your show.
Thank you. I'm going to start out with an overarching question. Why did you decide to write Ecology and Socialism?
Well, for the main reason I would say that I decided to write the book was I've been interested in environmental issues since I was young. I lived a lot of my life outdoors. And still do whenever I get the chance. And so the environment is very integral to my life. And on top of that, my background is in science. So bringing those two things together, along with a sense of activism, that there's something wrong with the world and we should try and change it, really moved me to write the book. And then more specifically, having read many environmental books or books about the environment and the crisis and so on, very often you spend the first 90% of the book reading about how terrible things are, and yet you get to the last 10 or 15 pages and the solutions put forward are so minimal and so divorced from the scale of the problem that was just described in the rest of the book that it's almost laughable in some cases. And so so you go through this whole series of great depression in terms of reading the books, and then there's no real solutions to my mind. So I wanted to, in contrast, write a book that has a more systemic, historical critique of the whole system. But only half of the book would be that, and then the other half was about short-term, meaningful solutions, and then looking towards a longer-term solution. What would a totally different society run on a completely different basis really look like, and how could that be sustainable? So that was some of the motivation for originally writing the book.
And why do you feel that capitalism is and environmental protection are incompatible?
Well, really for three reasons. One is that it is a system predicated on endless growth, and there's clearly a logical contradiction there in terms of you can't have an infinite growth economy on a finite planet. And the evidence for that we see all around us. Whenever there's a recession, and we've been going through a horrendous recession for the last 3 or 4 years, then ever since 2008 really, then what's the solution? All the politicians talk about is growth. We need to grow the economy, and everything needs to become bigger, and that's how we're going to get people back to work. And what that means within a system, the second thing, within a system based on profit as its prime motivating force, in fact, its overriding directive, is the hunt for more profits, then not only do you get an expansion of the system, but you get an expansion of the system based on creating more waste, greater and greater use of natural resources on the one hand, and then more waste at the other end. And it's a very linear process. And so those two things, profit and the expansion, which is built into the system, then you combine that with what else comes along, which is the short-term outlook of capitalist society, in that you are always concerned with what's just around the corner and making more profit tomorrow than you made today, then it makes it very difficult, if not impossible, to plan for the long term. And obviously that's exactly the kind of thinking that you need if you're talking about sustainability issues and environmental issues over generations to come. And so for those reasons, I think it's impossible to say that anything other than capitalism is inherently anti-ecological at its core, and we're just now finding out the limits of the punishment that is being meted out to the Earth and a stable biosphere in terms of what it can absorb without radical change to climate, which we're starting to experience. So for those reasons, really, outside of the international implications, which I could talk about a little bit too.
Definitely. Would you like to discuss the international implications?
Yeah. The other thing that I think a lot of environmentalists don't pay sufficient attention to, and many people in general, is the international dimension. And the competition that goes on between different corporations is mirrored on a larger scale by the competition that goes on between countries. In other words, inter-imperial competition. And so as evidence of that, we've had almost very close to 2 decades, 20 years, of negotiations on climate, right? So what has been achieved in those 20 years? Essentially nothing. In fact, we've gone backwards from the Kyoto Protocol, which is actually expiring this year, and it was supposed to bring down carbon dioxide emissions, one of the main contributors to global warming. It was supposed to bring down those emissions by 8 to 12%, depending on who you were. And since that time, CO2 emissions have gone up by 50%. So even the best, supposedly the best international agreement, the only binding agreement actually that we have, the Kyoto Protocol, has failed. And there's nothing left to replace it. There's no forward momentum with regard to climate talks. And in 2009 in Copenhagen, when Obama was supposed to fly in and be a savior, he actually wrecked the talks. And we got nothing. And since then, it's been a declining series of expectations. And so I think that the inability of capitalist nations to come up with a binding and thought-out plan that is internationally regulated and put forward and that will actually do something is evidence of the fact that they don't want to, because if one country does more environmentally than another country, then immediately it's disadvantaged in the competition for profits. And so none of them can do it unless all of them can do it, and they all have different, slightly different interests, so they can't agree. And so we're left with a planet that is on fire in many respects. Large parts of the United States were on fire over the last couple of years, and not to mention Russia in 2010, and yet they still can't come up with anything except meaningless platitudes about what they want to do for their children. And yet we're faced with a situation where the climate is clearly worsening and really nothing is being done, or very little is being done, I should say, either nationally or internationally.
Definitely. And as we acknowledge these environmental crises going on, we also hear from leaders that we have to improve consumerism or boost consumerism and buy more to get us out of these big financial crises that we're in. Given all that that's going on, what is the relationship between Marxism and environmentalism, and how can socialism help to alleviate some of these problems?
Great questions. I think because if you're going to indict the system as the problem, then there's two immediate questions that kind of follow on from that. One is, well, how are you going to get rid of it? And then the second question is, what are you going to replace it with? So Marx has often been erroneously tarred with the brush of endless growth in the same way that capitalists were. Sometimes he's critiqued as someone who is all for more factories and more businesses and so on, as long as they're run by the workers instead of the capitalists, and then basically everything will be fine. But actually, if you go back and read many of his writings, including Capital, which is his central masterpiece, there are lots and lots of examples of ecological thinking. His concern was obviously not with climate change, but he was very concerned with the degradation of the soil. And he talked quite eloquently, him and Frederick Engels, his collaborator, about the degradation of the soil brought on by the short-term profit-driven interests of capitalist-based agriculture, which is, of course, something that we see 10 or 100-fold now with agribusiness and Monsanto and so on and so forth, always looking for short-term profit in the interests of long-term planning with regard to the fertility of the soil. So he was very concerned with that. And beyond specific environmental issues that he was thinking about, he also has a method of looking at history, historical materialism, which examines the past in order to inform the future. And so that necessarily brings in a longer-term way of thinking that is, in my mind, very, very helpful for the situation that we are in now, where he talks about preserving the earth and in order for future generations to enjoy it. And so I think that that kind of outlook, which is very similar to, for example, the Iroquois idea of 7 generations, that's how far into the future you should be looking in terms of what needs to be done. All this idea of usufruct, which is an old word, that means that you can share things and use them as long as you don't leave it in a worse state for the people who come after you.
Definitely.
And that is also part of Marx's writing. So I think both in terms of method and in terms of specific examples that he was concerned about ecologically, we can see a real benefit to going back to Marxism and using Marxism as a tool to understand our ecological crisis and the roots of that ecological crisis in the social crisis, which both of which are created and by a system that we really no longer need. It has outlived its usefulness, and I would argue that the exploitation of humanity that goes on by a tiny percentage at the top of this society, the 1%, if you want to call them that, that exploitation of the vast majority in the interests of a small minority is just the mirror image and the flip side of the exploitation of the natural world that goes on by the same system. And Marx talked directly about that, about how the life of the worker was stunted and robbed in the same way that the life of the soil was stunted and robbed by the system of capitalist agriculture or capitalism in general. So I think it's a pretty powerful analytical technique for looking at the dual crisis that we face, and therefore, if they have the same roots, then we really need to look at some kind of radical alternative.
And I'm just going to butt in here quickly. We actually have a caller to ask a question. Caller, you are on the air. Please state your name and question.
My name is Phil. My question is, I think that a lot of people get it now. The Sandy event really crystallized in a lot of people's minds, including Republican Mayor Bloomberg's mind, the whole concept of climate change and the disaster that we are compounding in this global system of weather and climate and everything that results from that. So with that as a backdrop, I'd like to ask if the common man, and 70% now believe, I understand, that negative climate events are affected by the greenhouse gases that we are pouring into the atmosphere. If that is true, that 70% get it, or at least in some measure get it, why isn't it that the captains of industry and the leaders of our government, including Obama, who gave what I consider to be very feeble credence to this in his campaign, aren't taking more radical action to save the planet, including an intent to reduce human population to sustainable levels, which globally are said to be about 1.5 billion instead of the 7.1 billion we now have? Why aren't they taking action? What is going to be, in their minds, the consequence of not taking action? Is it an apocalypse where only the ultra-wealthy themselves, in other words, survive?
Thank you, caller. Your response?
Well, I do agree that a lot of people get it in terms of climate change, including large majorities of Americans, all the latest polls, Democrat, Republican, Independent, indicate that overwhelming numbers agree that this is a real problem. Climate change is real, that we are causing it, humans, and something should be done about it. And so there is a huge disjunction between the concerns of ordinary people and the political class, particularly in the United States, which has become essentially divorced from reality. It seems that no extent of disaster, I mean, we've already had Hurricane Katrina that buried 80% of New Orleans below water, and now we've had Hurricane Sandy that turned large areas of New York into lakes, swimming pools, and so on and so forth, and people are still trying to recover from that without power, water, etc. No amount of warnings from Mother Nature seem to change the direction of the politicians into real action, translate that into real action. No amount of scientific reports. I mean, there's no real disagreement, and there hasn't been for a long time, really, amongst climate scientists that global warming is real, it's happening, and we're causing it. And yet they still don't listen. So that's why I think even people who profess to be concerned about it, like Obama did when he said actually in 2007 in his original election campaign that it was his number one priority to do something to, you know, stop the rise of the seas. And yet he hasn't done anything, well, very minimal things in 4 years. And his first press conference, even though he mentioned it after his re-election, obviously he never used climate change once since essentially 2009. He's not really talked about it. But his first press conference said he didn't think that it would be part of the negotiations to avoid what is now, you know, being called the fiscal cliff. What I would be far more concerned with is going over carbon cliff, because I think that's the one that we're really approaching, and there's no way around that. I think there are lots of ways of avoiding a fiscal cliff that you could just start taxing the rich and getting income tax from the corporations. Two-thirds of U.S. corporations pay no income tax, for example. So, but there's no way of avoiding the carbon cliff without reducing carbon output from the burning of fossil fuels, and there's no indication that the United States is on track to do anything about that. And I think that that is specifically because of the nature of the system. It doesn't really matter once you're in power what you're, whether you're good, bad, evil, whatever, or whether you've got some understanding of the science. I think you are compelled by the logic of the system to go along with it, and that means short-term interests and profit, so that any corporation that was acting outside of its baseline interests and taking more concern with environmental questions. I mean, there's a reason that there are government regulators for every single industry in the country and around the world, because if there weren't, then the corporations would cut every single corner that they possibly could with regard to health and safety and the environment, as they have historically done, and as they try to do. I mean, look at BP, as they try to do all the time. So it really does take the state to regulate that out at the very least, and they're not doing that because we've had 30 years of neoliberalism, which argues that the state is the problem and should be minimized, and everything else should be privatized. So I think that that is compounding a problem that pre-exists because of the nature of the system, in that it's always driven by short-term interests. The state is supposed to coordinate and look out for some longer-term interests and prevent corporations from just going wild, but it's kind of got out of that business to a large extent. And so I think some serious reforms would be greater regulation of corporations, but I think ultimately there's always a question that they're going to try and back out of any commitments that they make, and so we would need a completely different way of organizing without a profit motive if we were really going to get anywhere.
Do you believe that in light of Hurricane Sandy, the administration does see climate change as a more urgent matter, or do you think that Hurricane Sandy will have no effect on the policies of the administration?
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty interesting. One would hope that it would have some effect, right? At least they're talking about it now. I mean, the White House made a decision in 2009 not to use the word climate change or phrase climate change. And only talk about clean energy. which means that obviously if you're not going to talk, and many large environmental groups went along with that, by the way, if you're only going to talk about the need for clean energy but not the need for why you would want clean energy, then you've undermined your own argument and you lose. And so clearly that's what we've seen as we've gone backwards on the question over the last couple of years or so. On the other hand, you know, Bloomberg did put on the front of his magazine, Business Week, it's global warming, stupid, as a as the headline of last week's Business Week. And he endorsed Obama as perhaps doing something more serious about climate change than a President Romney would have done. On the other hand, as I mentioned, Obama has already made a press conference to say we can't really do anything because we've got other things to worry about, i.e. growing the economy. And secondly, I mean, they just had a vote about whether they would allow, in Congress, whether they would allow the European Union to tax American airlines, with all the variety of different American airlines, not the specific company, to fly in and out of Europe at about $3 a passenger per flight. And the Senate voted unanimously just before the election to prevent the EU from doing that, saying it was an attack on U.S. sovereignty. And the House just voted the same way post-Sandy, not unanimously, but very close to that on a voice vote. There was only one dissenting argument from the floor to say that that was not right. We should not do that. And so even a minimal carbon trading type idea coming from the European Union to actually regulate what is a major and growing emitter of carbon dioxide, the airline industry, was ruled out by U.S. politicians unanimously in the case of the Senate. Everybody voted for it to not do that, and by large majority in the House. And so I don't really see an awful lot of evidence for a redirection of the economy towards the kind of investments that we would need, which means primarily, first and foremost, shutting down the coal plants and rehiring those workers to go and do the kind of jobs that we really need, because they're all highly skilled workers, and we need those people to work in other areas. And it would also mean stopping the expansion of offshore drilling and the drilling that's about to start in the Arctic, in order to prioritize other things, such as energy conservation and renewables. And yet none of those things are really happening on anything like the scale that we need. So, and you know, the latest projection actually from Citibank in one of their most recent reports is that the U.S. is on track to become, in their words, I quote, the new Middle East. In other words, oil is expanding in the United States and around the world, as it happens. And so we're on exactly the wrong direction, trajectory in terms of doing anything. So I don't. It doesn't seem to me that they are taking it at all seriously.
And when looking at the impacts of Hurricane Sandy again, we often see images of New York and New Jersey, but Haiti was also devastated by the storm. How will the impacts of global warming affect vulnerable communities in the developing world? Will the impacts of climate change disproportionately harm poorer nations?
Well, I think it will absolutely disproportionately harm poor people. I mean, they are the people who bear the brunt of everything, and we already saw that in New Orleans. In this country, so you certainly don't have to go to another country to see the disparate effects and disproportionate effects of natural disasters on the poor versus the wealthy. And there are already many hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of climate refugees as the climate is changing. I mean, the climate has been stable for the last 12,000 years or so, which just happens to coincide, or perhaps not just happens, to coincide with the rise of human civilization, fixed, settled communities, towns and cities and so on, and the rise of agriculture. And, of course, if you don't have a stable climate where you can make predictions about what's going to, when the rains are going to come, how much and so on, and where they're going to fall, then agriculture, it becomes increasingly difficult to have. And so people around the world in already hard-hit areas are facing exactly that kind of question and are having to move around. So we're seeing migrations around the world because of that. We're also seeing clear evidence of the same situation in this country in terms of while the East Coast was underwater, from Hurricane Sandy, the vast majority of the rest of the country is still in drought, unprecedented drought over the last 12 months or so. And or at least you'd have to go back to the 1930s to see anything of its equivalent. And so I think that this is a problem for all, the entire population of the planet. But I totally agree that the people who are going to feel it first and feel it hardest are the people least able to cope. And we see that right here in New York, where certain communities, poor communities and communities of color, because of racism, have been left last in terms of getting their lives back together, getting electricity, getting running water, having food distributed to them, and so on and so forth. So the response here has been completely inadequate. And, you know, when you contrast that with the fact that they could take 200,000 soldiers at kind of the drop of a hat over to invade another country several thousand miles away in order to secure what is actually killing the planet, the burning of fossil fuels and oil. I'm talking about Iraq in 2003. They managed to get all of those soldiers over there, all of the hardware, the tanks, the ships, the planes, etc., and launch a war for oil. And yet they can't even save their own countrymen and give adequate support post a natural or climate-induced natural disaster when it's at the other end of Long Island. And so that clearly illustrates the priorities of the system are totally backward, and it needs to be replaced, in my opinion, with something more rational, equitable, and genuinely sustainable.
You're listening to A Public Affair here on WORT 89.9 in Madison. I'm your host, Anjali Brecky, and today we're speaking with Professor Chris Williams about capitalism and environmental degradation. You can join the conversation by calling 256-2001 here in Madison or 866-899-9678 toll-free. The author Daniel Quinn once wrote in his book Ishmael, "I have amazing news for you. Man is not alone on this planet. He is part of a community upon which he depends absolutely." Why do you think the mainstream view in our society is to perceive nature as a force which we must dominate and control rather than a system which we are a part of and upon which we depend?
Well, that's a great question. And I actually think that relates. I talk about that a little bit in my book because I think that very much relates to the origins of capitalism and science, which, you know, I'm involved in teaching and educating people about. Because previously, prior to the rise of capitalism around 400 years or so ago, most people's idea of the planet was a much deeper connection. Things were seen much more organically and holistically. We were all connected to each other and the animals and the plants and so on. And you don't have to be some mystical spiritual believer to argue for a more holistic, as I do, and as Marx did actually, for a more holistic understanding of our place and interconnection with each other and the natural world. But what capitalism did, if you want to make money, then and you want to make it as fast as possible, then you need to understand the world. And that's why science, scientific revolution, comes around at the same time as the rise of capitalism. And Francis Bacon, one of the original philosophers in the 1600s in Britain, was pretty clear on how nature should be viewed, first as a woman, and secondly as something to be violated and probed and dissected in order to, and he uses very explicit misogynistic language to describe what needs to be done to Mother Nature. That she should be taken by her forelock and as a slave and subjugated and so on and so forth in very violent language. Because what do you want to do? You want to understand nature in order to exploit it, in order to extract profit from it. And so the overall guiding philosophy of capitalism and with respect to nature and science is very reductive, is to say, which on the one hand has been tremendously successful, obviously. We've advanced a lot in our understanding of the world by this method, but also has some real limitations in terms of looking at us not as separate from the environment as something complete. And I, you know, many people now will not use the word environment because it kind of posits an out there somewhere is the environment, and we are somewhere else, as opposed to the word ecological, which kind of indicates a togetherness, that we're part of the natural world. And if you read some of the economists, some of which I quote in my book, they literally do believe and argue that even with the breakdown of the biosphere and ecosystems and so on, it will just have a few percentage points negative effect on GDP. And so there is this belief that we really are independent of nature, that we could exist without it in some sense, which is obviously ludicrous when you actually examine it. And yet many mainstream economists argue that way. And I would say that that is linked to arguments that go back to the very genesis of this system based on exploitation and a profit-driven directive.
I'm going to butt in here because we have three callers on the line. Caller, you are on the air. Please state your name and question.
I'm John, and I'm wondering what organization you're connected with, what you can suggest, what we can connect with to achieve eco-socialism.
Thank you for your question. Your response?
I can totally give an answer to that. On the one hand, I helped to bring the union to my workplace at Pace University, so we have a union there, New York State Union of Teachers. I'm very excited about that. So I work in my union. The other thing, more broadly, and I was actually in Madison, Wisconsin for the fantastic uprising last year, because I traveled there as a union activist and as a socialist to see what I could do and what solidarity I could offer while the Capitol building was being occupied. And it was a fantastic, incredible experience to be in a town dominated by ordinary working people and their concerns. But more broadly, I'm also a member of the ISO, the International Socialist Organization, which has a branch in Madison. You can check it out at UW-Madison, and I think another branch also in the town. Anyway, so that's the organization that I am currently affiliated with, because I think that is, even though small, is an organization that espouses the kind of politics that I think are necessary, which means that we want to fight for reforms right now, real reforms to the system, to give us some breathing room and to build up our organization and sense of confidence, but also ultimately wants to see the back of capitalism and institute something that is based on real democracy, cooperation, and producing the things that we need as opposed to the things that make the most money in the shortest amount of time.
Next caller, you are on the air. Please state your name and question.
Hi. I don't know whether I heard right, but I think your guest said that the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate voted, you know, at different times not to allow American corporations to be taxed, or was it taxed or regulated by European or maybe any other, you know, non-U.S. entities? And that seems to me, you know, whichever it was, obviously, U.S. corporations are completely out of control. They're trying to avoid regulation everywhere, and they're trying to avoid taxes everywhere. But I don't see how the U.S., you know, with the world trade apparatus, with free trade agreements, the WTO and so forth, it seems to me that national, you know, votes to protect their own industries are pretty much null and void at this point, because the global apparatus is overriding national efforts to control and tax. So I just wondered why the House and Senate votes had any effect at all in this global, you know, corporate controlled world.
Thank you very much, caller. And to our last caller, if you do call us back, we'd be happy to take your question. Your response?
Congress was specifically voting against the idea that there was a new law being put forward by the European Union that any airlines flying in or out of the European Union should pay a carbon tax, essentially, because of the emissions given off by airlines. and that money would go to support decarbonizing projects that the European Union was supporting. Now, whatever you think of that, I mean, I think it's a pretty minimal thing. And obviously the corporations, the airlines, would just pass those extra costs on to the passenger. So it was estimated that it would be about cost the average passenger about extra $3 per flight. And Congress said, we're not doing it. And the European Union actually backed off and said, okay, we're not going to do it. We'll put the decision off whether to implement this law that we wanted for 12 months until next September, under pressure from the United States, obviously. And now the question of whether that will become law, that U.S. Refusal, is essentially going to Obama to see whether he'll veto it or not now that it's passed both houses. But it indicates that U.S. politicians and the corporations that essentially bankroll them are saying, we're not going to pay anything to mitigate our carbon emissions. And because it's not like U.S. airlines don't pay landing taxes and all kinds of other things when they fly in and out of different countries. And so it's not some crazy idea that undermines the sovereignty of the U.S. or something. It's just they specifically did not want to pay it because it was related to a cost associated with the production of carbon dioxide through burning fossil fuels, in this case, inside airplanes or by airplanes. So the WTO is essentially run by the United States in its own interests. And so that's why the U.S. can get away with a lot of things that other countries would just not be able to get away with. It's the largest economy with far the largest military, and so it can go around doing exactly what it wants. I mean, the U.S. produces 25% of all CO2 emissions, carbon, global warming emissions, and pollution, and yet is only about 4% of world population. And so it's one of the biggest offenders, and also simultaneously the country that has done the least to address the issue and is the most recalcitrant and backwards when it comes to international climate negotiations. It is intent on wrecking them at every opportunity.
And we have two more callers for you. Next caller, you are on the air. Please state your name and question.
Just a moment. All right. I wonder if your guest could comment on the idea of a moral universe. That what we need is originally the idea of the household unit as basic in our economy, and how do we limit excess households so that wealth and power are not quantitative units but moral units, so that we work for a just distribution of wealth and power, not a quantitative distribution based upon more and less and excess. Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling back. Your response?
Well, I do think that we certainly need a different way of looking and valuing things, because in this society, the only thing that really gets valued is how much money you make and how many things you buy. And everything is mediated by the commodity, the buying and selling of commodities. In fact, human beings, our labor power, is just turned into something else that gets bought and sold. And that dehumanizes and alienates us from each other and the rest of the natural world. We don't even really know what it means to be fully human, because we are so powerless underneath this kind of crushing global system of capitalism. And so rather than think about what I need to, or what anybody needs to buy or own, what about thinking much more about relationships, whether they're family relationships or friendship relationships or any other kind of relationship, I think is the important point, rather than thinking about the way in which we have things. I mean, when you think about it, owning cars, for example, is a crazy idea for any number of reasons. One, because they're incredibly inefficient when you're driving them. They're only about 25% efficient. So every gallon of gas you put into an internal combustion engine in a car, 75% of that is just wasted as heat immediately. very incredibly inefficient. But then cars were only actually in use about 5% of the time. 95% of the time they're parked. And so even when they're not being used, they're an environmental menace, because look at the amount of space that cars take up when they're not in use, the amount of resources that you used to build all of those cars, and look at the vast oceans of impermeable concrete and tarmac all over the country. In fact, there are enough non-residential parking spaces for cars for 800 million cars in the United States. I mean, there are some cities where one-third of the surface area of the city is taken up by non-residential parking spaces. So how could we, instead of owning our own individual cars, institute infrastructure that promotes togetherness and sociality in terms of public transport? So massively enhancing public transport, where the object is not to own individual things, but to share and communicate on something that is not owned. I mean, if you think about it, socializing things is not a crazy idea. I mean, when was the last time you ever heard of anybody complaining about libraries, where they just give you books and allow you to read them for free? That is one small example of the kind of alternative that we could replicate on any number of levels. I mean, if you think about why does everybody need their own washer and dryer when they're used, what, maybe an hour a week at most, when there's different ways of organizing that that make much more sense.
That's a good point. I want to get our last caller in. Caller, you are on the air. Please state your name and question.
David. And I just wanted to thank Professor Williams for a fascinating half hour. And what I found really interesting earlier was when he was speaking of kind of a parallel, I think is what he was drawing, between the fiscal cliff that we face and the carbon or ecological cliff that he thinks is even more important, and I entirely agree. It just seems like right now there's a social or more of a corporate or political ideology right now talking its way around the issue, but I wonder if the professor believes deep down whether or not these corporations or politicians feel like even when we are beyond this cliff, is there a deep down ideology that we can buy or talk our way out of this cliff?
Thank you, caller. Your response, Professor?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think that there's a very easy way of avoiding this so-called fiscal cliff, which is not a real cliff anyway. As I mentioned earlier, we could increase taxes on the very well-off substantially. How about back to levels that used to exist in the 1960s, 93% tax rate above if you made more than $1 million. Mayor Bloomberg, you know, some of the cost of fixing the city or putting in sea barriers, for example, was costed out at between $10 and $15 billion, but one person could pay off that. That's how disparate, how inequitable our society is. Mayor Bloomberg himself as an individual is valued at $25 billion, so he could pay off what needs to happen to the city and still be a multi-billionaire. He wouldn't even notice the money gone. So I think that there's no sense, there's no indication that capitalism is about to change course to try something different or behave in a different way. Not that obviously it's got a behavior or tries things, because it's a system. But there's clearly now, we have in contradiction a climate system and a capitalist economic system, and one of those has to give. And left to its own devices, there's no indication, no evidence to support the argument that capitalism will change from being an expansive, profit-driven system. And so we need to get rid of it, and pretty quickly. Because if we don't, they're going to still be talking about fiscal cliffs, which we could easily solve. What about putting to work? I mean, there are 500,000 unemployed people just in New York City. What about re-employing them to do the kind of infrastructural changes that need to happen? According to the city, 41% of our bridges are in poor repair. We only recycle, not the recycling is to be all and end all of what we could do by any stretch of the imagination, should be the last thing you do, not the first thing. But the city only recycles 15% of its solid waste. The sanitation system is totally inadequate and falling apart, not just in this city, but across the country. I mean, there are so many infrastructure things that need doing, and yet all we do is pile more money into the military and the banksters to continue ripping us off and start wars around the world. So, many of them to protect oil. So I think that we need a complete reordering of the whole of society, and we need to work towards that. We need more revolutionaries in this country, to be perfectly frank and open about it. And the natural power of the oceans, the natural power of the tides, of the winds, the power of scientific rationality, these are not enough to convince our politicians or the corporations to change course. So we need a larger power, and that, I believe, is the power of the people, the organized social power that has the power to transform worlds and has in the past. And so I think we need to resurrect the kind of radicalism that existed in of the social movements in the 1960s with the sense of unionism and organization of the 1930s and go beyond that and really be talking about some of the questions that came up in Wisconsin just last year. I mean, on the one hand, it's quite depressing to be talking about all this stuff, and in many ways it is. But on the other hand, I'm tremendously optimistic about the future because I think people are beginning to fight back, and we've entered into a new era of revolt and rebellion, typified by the Arab Spring, typified by the uprising in Wisconsin, and, of course, Occupy since that time over the last year or so. So I think people are starting to realize that there is a connection between the economic system and the ecological crisis, and are starting to ask these bigger questions about, well, what are we really going to do about it? How are we going to organize? Because you can't do anything on your own. You need to get together with others and force a change in priorities, because they have one set of priorities, the people at the top, which is just making more money for the sake of making money. And we have another set of priorities that contradicts that. And it's a question of how do we organize and get together to reestablish our power and work towards an alternative.
And we have less than 5 minutes in the show, so I want to get in our next caller. Caller, you are on the air. Please state your name and question.
Yeah, my name is Kyle.
Hello.
Yeah, okay. And my question and comment is that if we were to actually carbon tax people, the corporations, they couldn't produce their products in China because that's a hugely subsidized shipping industry, and saving 25 cents per product would be offset by their taxes. We'd have to produce things back in America, and we'd have to make jobs at home and in every country. We wouldn't be able to ship things around the world any longer.
Thank you, caller, for your comments. Professor, your response?
China's an interesting country because so much of world production has been offshored. Absolutely consciously by the corporations. They don't want to pay workers. They don't want to take care of environmental questions. And so they hunt around for the cheapest place where they can produce things at the largest profits. So first of all, NAFTA created the maquiladoras over the border in Mexico, which has like devastated the Mexican population. And since that time, they found an even cheaper location in China, where all of the iPhones, where Dell computers, where they make pretty much everything now. 95% of world production of bicycles is from China. And then they turn around and then blame China for creating all of these carbon emissions and building more coal plants and so on and so forth, when they are the ones who basically offshored not only their workforce but also their carbon emissions. So the European Union gets to sound really good because its carbon emissions are going down, but what about why they are? Because much of the industry was displaced to China, who are working in horrendous, the workers there, horrendous sweatshop conditions and are fighting against it. Would a carbon tax help that? I mean, I think that's why more than ever we have to view things on an international basis. I mean, going back to Marx, we, the workers of the world, have no country. We are internationalists, and so how do we link up with our brothers and sisters from other countries? Because I would argue we have far more in common with Chinese workers in the United States than we do with American rulers who are responsible for the system. So how can we build links to say we're not going to tolerate sweatshop labor in China? And rather than talk about American jobs, let's talk about jobs for the people who need them. And how do we make sure that they're environmentally sound and directed in the ways that we want? I mean, at one point, the U.S. government owned GM and Chrysler when they got bailed out. Why didn't we stop them producing SUVs and other climate-damaging products and have them start making wind turbines and train track, the things that we actually need? I mean, it wouldn't be that hard to switch those factories over to make those things. I mean, they did it in the Second World War on a dime. They changed the economy from producing consumer goods to weapons and jeeps and so on and so forth. So it's not unprecedented that we could make that kind of change. And create a country that is genuinely worthy of the 21st century. A country controlled and run in the interests of ordinary people and the planet that we so clearly depend on for our ability to stay alive.
Thank you so much. And we have about 1 minute left in the program. I was just thinking, as you were talking, about the great deep ecology movement leader, Arne Naess, who said the supporters of shallow ecology think that reforming human relations toward nature can be done within the existing structure of society. To those environmentalists who do care about environmental degradation, but who only believe that change is possible within the current system, what would you say to them? You have about 30 seconds.
I mean, I would say we need to fight for some real reforms. I'm all for that. We cannot just stand aside and wait for the revolution, right? Because it won't come. We need to fight for some real reforms right now, which is not carbon tax, which is not fracking instead of using coal. It is for shutting down the fossil fuel plants and re-employing the workers. And I would say you can't be an environmental justice activist without being simultaneously a social justice activist. I don't think we're going to get any ecological justice without some social justice.
Thank you
very
much,
Chris
Williams.
You really have to meld those two together.
Thank you very much.
I would argue for a longer-term outlook as well, a completely different society.
Thank you. And we have run out of time, but we were talking with Chris Williams, professor of physics and chemistry at Pace University. Thank you so much for your time, and you are listening to A Public Affair.